very high, very great, and very far spreading. It is the water of life from the all-compassing sea of God. You have sought for the form. You have gone astray. You cannot find it because you have abandoned reality. Sometimes it is named tree, sometimes sun, sometimes it is named sea, sometimes cloud.
The lantern.
Under the light of lantern, we'll look at the story, which indicates a moral aspects of our life.
So there's a hadith from Imam Ali alayhi salam. I think, if I'm not mistaken, I just looked at this hadith, but my memory doesn't help me right now. I think His Eminence says that experience could, in some cases, even be more valuable than knowledge itself. And to determine whether or not we have wisdom in ourselves, everyone, I think, has a level of wisdom towards certain things, but that objective wisdom that could reflect in their worldview, that could help with their life purpose and their self-betterment, is the main wisdom that we should all be aiming for, and it's the main wisdom that Islam emphasizes on so much. One of the tools that is advised the most in order to achieve any sort of wisdom in life is silence. Now, I know it might be very hypocritical for me to be saying that because I'm literally getting paid to talk, but this is just a safe place for us to remind ourselves of these things. And whether it is in the narrations of the Ahlul Bayt or it's in the advices and the rule books, you know, that are presented by the scholars and the ulama, there is perhaps no tool in this world that can help with achieving wisdom like silence. Now, silence doesn't mean becoming a wallflower and marginalizing ourselves in life and not getting involved in life issues and matters, though to a certain degree I feel as an active introvert that's not a problem either. But silence means not to talk about things that will not benefit your life in this world or the hereafter. And God knows we do that a lot. Sometimes we're in a situation that calls for conversation. You know, we're in a meeting, we're meeting, the family of our future spouse. We want to get to know each other. I can't say that, like every other hadith, this must be looked in its own context and proper occasion. I can't say that, oh, I want to be a wise person, so I'm going to sit here in this family meeting and not say a single word. Well, that's going to be ridiculous, and it's going to defeat the purpose of getting to know your future in-laws, right? So we have to look at the situation as well. Or if you're a radio host, you can't say that, well, I'm going to be totally silent on today's show because I don't want to come across as someone shallow-minded. I want to be wise and gain wisdom. Again, defeats the objective of a radio show. But in situations where if I keep silent, nothing is going to be lost. As a matter of fact, it could be a good opportunity for me to reflect, contemplate, and listen. Now, this is very important because I was going through an article that was talking about the importance of wisdom. And one of the points that they mentioned in order to gain wisdom is to listen more than you speak, because we said that life experience brings wisdom, right? And we're not going to learn anything from hearing ourselves speak. We already know what we have to say, right? Those thoughts are crossing our mind on a daily basis. if we are going to gain any new knowledge or wisdom, it's going to be through receiving it from other sources, other people, other lectures. So listening is a great way to gain wisdom, no matter what position you have in life. Not only does you can say that I already have a lot of information and knowledge, but it is again through listening that we can expose ourselves to other people's viewpoints, other people's perspective, even if it's toward the knowledge we already have. Another great way to gain wisdom is to accept criticism. We can almost always tell when a criticism is addressed toward us for the objective of being helpful and constructive or destructive, right? And when there is genuine constructive criticism coming toward us, it's very important for us to lay down our ego and our pride and accept that, because otherwise there will be no chance of us improving ourselves and gaining that knowledge and experience which could lead to becoming a wiser person. Another hadith from Imam Ali alayhi salam, which I feel would help us in our path toward gaining wisdom, thus bettering ourselves and becoming the believer who's found their lost link, i.e. wisdom, is not to talk about things we don't have enough knowledge about. There's actually a hadith from Imam Ali, and God knows we do it a lot, whether it's on social media, whether it's in a friendly conversation. It is not a big deal to tell people, I don't know. I honestly don't know. And then keep quiet, either do research or listen to people who do know. I don't think 15 minutes would suffice when it comes to talking about wisdom or getting anywhere close to finding it in life. But inshallah ta'ala, all we can do is hope and strive and try our best in life to find that missing link. Until the next episode of The Lantern, I leave you in the care and protection of the Almighty. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
ألا بذكر الله تطمئن القلوب.
Aperture.
Welcome back to Aperture, everyone. In the first part, we saw how Lorna Taichasup made her first trip to Iraq just before the start of the war to reveal the humanity of Iraq's citizens through her photojournalism. Consequently, her attempt to enlighten the American public turned to controversy as Fox News broadcasters called her efforts, quote, villainous and even bordering on treason, and accused her of aiding and abetting the enemy on the brink of war. But Lorna was never intimidated by such words. Instead, she continued her efforts to report stories that go beyond mainstream media coverage, and during her trips to Iraq, she endeavors to get as close to the people as possible and find her way to the ordinary people in the streets of Iraq. Well, stay with us for the second part of our documentary.
It appears that there were not weapons of mass destruction there.
You said you knew where they were.
I did not. I said I knew where suspect sites were, and
you
were just...
You said you knew where they were, near Tikrit, near Baghdad, and north, east, south, and west of there. Those are your words.
We flew back, and we spent 6 weeks living in an unprotected hotel, talking to as many Iraqis as possible, traveling in taxi cabs and in people's cars, people who started to befriend us after a while. This particular camp kind of adopted me because I would keep going back. A lot of journalists go to Iraq, they get the sexy story, they go home, they write about it, they never go back. These people, I usually go visit everyone. I try and visit everyone I've spoken to, like, you know, different people who I've had conversations with on each trip to see how they're doing, get a recap. They invited me to their eldest son's wedding, and this was wild. I mean, we had my interpreter and I and the videographer arrived at this squad camp. And all these women were all dolled up in this back room, and they put the Arabic music on, and they have the kerchiefs, and we're doing the dance, and we're just having like this blast. The Iraqi people are good-looking people. They love to look good. They're very fashionable. This is in a squat camp. These people are obviously very poor, but they're still, if they have only one set of clothes, they wash it every night. They go out, and they love to look good. Happiest when I'm there, you know, really, because you know you're doing your work. I feel like you're making some progress. You're helping the world a little bit.
Don't you think this building needs some love?
Yeah.
It's a big surprise. He's 90 years old. He's still working.
I think of those young and old people who we've impacted each other. They've taught me so much about their culture, about life in Iraq. They've allowed me an insider's glimpse.
I really had a great day. You will never believe the miracle that happened. We were waiting for a taxi across the street from the hotel. Suddenly, this taxi rolled slowly over to us, as if by magic. And the guy driving was the man in the photo walking with crutches with one leg. And he remembered me taking his photo, so we made arrangements for him to come to the hotel and see his picture. Did you know that at the last minute I grabbed my box of huge 20 by 24 photos? Yes, and I did have them here with me, and I can show people the photos. I gotta go now. My battery got fried yesterday when the electricity came on. I had no surge protector hooked to it. Much love to you, my sweetie. I'm missing you all the day long and talking to you in my heart. I miss you and love you very much. Love, Muma.
I have Commando Mommy photos, Liz. Where? I'm looking for them right now.
Commando.
We went over to Ala's house, and they wrapped me in a...
I want to be your president for 4 more years to make our future brighter and better for every one of our citizens. I want to be your president for 4 more years to make our country safe.
The Republican message is going to be, these are dangerous times, and President Bush will protect you.
And, you know, this is what we should be doing, and taking it to whatever degree we have to take it to. Getting arrested is not such a big thing when people are dying.
If we are a representative democracy, and we supposedly have control over our government, what are we going to do about it?
Attendance is estimated between 100,000 and 300,000 people, though no official figures have been released. Overall, the march, peaceful, except for some altercations. So far, police report 134 arrests.
2005, I went back for the first election, and I almost got killed a couple of times. I was only actually in the country for 10 days, and I didn't go back for a couple of years because I was terrified. I was caught in a crossfire shootout, and, you know, here I am, an unarmed American woman traveling, you know, with cameras. And I would think, I must have been crazy coming here and walking on these streets.
Every night at the hotel, darkness would come, and you'd hear, the machine gun fire out in the street or handgun fire out in the street, or sometimes they were, fighting each other. I don't know what was going on. Everywhere we went, there were guns. You can hear, them clicking the guns in the background. They're loading them, checking the clips. There's nothing like the sound of a Kalashnikov being loaded.
It was kind of no attitude. You're not killing us today. And if you want to kill us, go ahead. Try. It was it was so intense. Gunfire broke out at one point, and no one left. Like, people refused to move even though there was someone was shooting a gun at them. They told us, like, we went to the first polling place. They said, no, you cannot take any pictures of the National Guard or the police. So, yes, I'm not going to break the rules. Soon, everybody wants me to take their picture. The policeman in charge, he said, here, take my picture. He took someone's kid. He was kissing the kid. He said, I want you to take my picture.
Now, remember, this last trip was very dangerous for me. I had to wear hijab the entire time and my abaya. My camera bag was a hidden woman's bag where I had, you know, and I had a press pass. I was even afraid to show that at times that someone would take me out. There were over 250 political parties. Here's the election ballot boxes. People came in, they voted. And that's the other thing, a lot of political parties suddenly come popping out of the woodwork, you know, because, oh, now we have democracy. Do we know what that means? Now we have freedom. Do we know what that means? I mean, it was a very beautiful, exciting time to see these people emerging from this snuffed-out dictatorship state to be just thinking about, now we're free. The first 3 weeks there, I didn't talk. I didn't write a word. I was too afraid to, because I had to get my mind on it. I had to wrap my mind around it, and I had to open to what they were saying and not what I was feeling, or not what I went there thinking.
No one is interested in the truth. So did I want to hear that the people, half the people in Iraq, or, you know, certainly large numbers of people love Bush? No, I didn't want to hear that.
We are no killers, we are no terrorists, we are just looking for peace and beautiful life.
So what do you think should happen now? Point, I had two choices. I could have submerged myself and refused to hear them and to seek out people who supported my belief system, or I could listen to what they were saying and try to understand why they were saying it. And that's what I decided to do. And it was painful and it was hard and it was shocking to me. But the bottom line is, it's very complex. In fact, the first article I wrote was called Making Peace with All the Truths. It's not one truth. It's a multifaceted truth. And it may not make sense, and it's not black and white, and it's not right or wrong. It is complicated. But, you know, it doesn't fit into a sound bite, so we can't use it. And that's where I'm at. I don't know what I'm going to do. All I kept thinking the last 3 weeks I was there is I want to come home and plant my garden. Politics, the world, war.
Knowing what you know today, would you do the same thing all over again?
I think it is doubtful that without the weapons of mass destruction case, the President, the Congress, the United Nations, and those who joined us in the conflict, the British, the Italians, the Spanish, the Australians, would have found a persuasive enough case to support a decision to go to war.
Our troops home. I want all the children of the world home and not in a war situation. Okay? But we can't get the troops home now because we've opened up Pandora's box and people's lives are at risk. And it's about time. I mean, the left doesn't want to take responsibility for anything. The right doesn't want to take responsibility. We have to take responsibility. As an American, I have to take responsibility in my country. And I'm not going to abandon these people who I have gotten to know and who are telling me we're afraid that if you guys leave, the shit's going to hit the fan.
Would you classify your work, journalism, as anti-mainstream or alternative?
I don't think they have a category for me. I went to Iraq to bring home the face of the Iraqi people so that the people in my country could see who they were killing and maybe think, these are beautiful people, why would we want to kill them? Infantile idealism.
As a journalist, what are you going to do? Are you prepared for dying?
You can't go there unless you accept that you may not.
My name is Lorna Tychastev. I'm an editor, writer, and photojournalist. I've been working in and out of Iraq now since February 2003. I'm going to continue to name the names of the fallen from the state of New Mexico. Specialist Christopher A. Merville, age 26. Sergeant Moses Daniel Rocca, age 19.
The first time I read, the first 19-year-old, I had to like wait a whole minute because I didn't want to, you know, I had to.
Age 23. Private, first class, William C. Ramirez, age 19. Sergeant Trevor.
Sergeant Tommy L. Gray, age 34. Jaffer Hashim Majid, age 13. Wissam Hadi Duari, age 11. Daoud Kiss, age 55. Muhammad Agab, no age given. This is exactly where my photos belong, because people will see them. Ahmed Al Rifai, age 13. The face of the Iraqi people has found a home.
At some point, I realized I didn't know enough to truly report in depth on the issues that I was learning about. So I went back to school. I found a master's program at NYU in global affairs. And by that time, I had begun doing consulting work for an Iraqi NGO called Nature Iraq. Their work was to baseline the environmental conditions in the country while violence was still occurring. And I just thought that was phenomenal, and I chose that as my thesis topic. I graduated at the end of 2009, and shortly thereafter scored, you know, what I thought was my dream job, and working as a communications and outreach specialist for a USAID project in Baghdad. Their work had to do with training over 100,000 Iraqi civil servants in how to rebuild their country.
For nearly 9 years, our nation has been at war in Iraq. I'm proud to finally say these two words, and I know your families agree. Welcome home. Welcome home.
You know, my son called me a couple of days after 9/11 and said, hey, Mom, me and Mikey, we're going to sign up. We're going to go get them. And I was like, get who? As my, you know, heart stopped. And he said, we're going to get them, the people who did this. And I said, well, who did this? We don't know who did this. Who are you going to go get? Don't you think you should wait till we know who did this before you go get them? Sometimes I think I'm the one who went, so they wouldn't have to. Because I would rather it be me than them. I think I put a lot of faces where people had friendly, happy family faces to what people previously thought of as terrorists and scary and dark. And I think I was able to show a lot of people that, you know, we're not that much different. We all want basically the same things. We want a nice job so we can have a nice vacation. We want dinner on the table with our family at the end of the day. And we want to live in peace.
Lorna's haunting photographs and poignant stories enable her audience to share the tragedy, the struggle, the triumph of the Iraqi people. And they raise larger questions about the war, a war that was never necessary, which could have been stopped if only the warmongering governments heard the voice of the people. And that's it, everyone, for this week on Aperture. Until another episode right here on Aperture, goodbye.
IRIB English Radio presents Viewpoints.
Viewpoints.
With the presence of different scholars.
The presence of different scholars from IRIB English Radio.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. This is Viewpoints. You're listening to I'm Atta, the host of this program. With me in the studio are two guest speakers, Brother Ali Alavian and Sayyid Mohsen Naghvi. We want to talk about Iran's developments since 1979 in different fields and on different aspects. Brother Ali Alavian, assalamu alaikum, brother, and welcome to your show.
Wa alaikum assalam, and thank you for having me here.
You're welcome. And Sayyid Mohsen Naghvi, assalamu alaikum, brother, and welcome to your show.
Alaykum assalam wa rahmatullah. Thanks for inviting.
So, since the occurrence of the Islamic Revolution of Iran in 1979, about 42 years have passed, and in these, we can say 42 years, different achievements and developments were made by the Islamic Republic of Iran. You know, today we want to talk a little bit crystal clear about such developments since 1979 in Iran, and let's get first to one of the most important things, which has been among the main slogans and the mottos of the late Imam Khomeini, and that is establishing social justice. So, Sayyid Mohsen Naghvi, let's start with you, brother. Wasn't really before the Islamic Revolution of Iran at the Pahlavi time, Shah time, social justice achieved in Iran? Now, you can see that in the slogans and the mottos, we can say, that are chanted during the demonstrations which took place in 1979. You see the people, both men and women, are looking and chanting for social justice. Make a comparison for us, brother.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Well, when we want to compare two times and to see two different, we can say, like maybe the systems, obviously we have to refer towards the values or the indexes that are available online, obviously. Maybe the international, we can say, surveys that had happened. Generally speaking, obviously, we know that at the time of, before the revolution, the poverty rate was high in Iran. And obviously, people did not have that much resources which they needed. And on top of that, if we look at one of the reports that generally talks about the inequality in the society, which is known as Gini Index, it also shows different rates, because it shows like before even 1986 or 1979, it was around 47%. Now, what is a Gini report? Gini report basically shows between 0 to 100, and the more you go towards zero, it means that the resources are distributed amongst the people, so the people are equally getting their own, like the shares from the government. And as far as it goes towards the 100, it means like the people are getting less, and there are the individuals who are getting more benefit out of it. Mm-hmm. The report, especially when we look at the World Bank report of the Gini Index, according to the World Bank data, we can see like in the 1986, it was a couple of years after the revolution, the Gini Index shows like the value of 47.40%, which means like half of the shares, you can say, were distributed amongst the people and half were not. But whereas in 2014, the latest value that is available on the website for Iran, that shows this rate to be reduced to 37%, 38 to 37%.
That's right.
And this shows that after the Islamic Revolution, obviously the government or the system It is paying attention towards the people,
okay,
towards their social, we can say, like, it's moving towards the social justice, because
okay,
in the eyes of world, we can talk in the numbers.
Right.
In regards to the social justice. Otherwise, obviously, someone has to come and do the survey. On top of that, obviously, we do not see, homeless in Iran on the streets the way we see in America or maybe UK or maybe Europe or maybe Turkey, the country which is next to
okay,
Iran, or maybe in Pakistan or India. We can see many homeless people who are living in the streets, who are sleeping in the streets, who do not have anything to eat. They're eating from the garbages they collect and all those things. But we don't see those things in Iran, especially
okay,
maybe because the government has a special scheme for that they have a special area. Even if we look at the streets, if you walk through the streets, you cannot see as compared to them. I don't know if there is any. I haven't seen yet.
You haven't seen yet. There, for sure, in every land, there are some poor people, you know, and poor part of the society. And 42 years is not an ideal time, really, for a government like Islamic Revolution of Iran in order to establish justice in the full sense of the word. Especially, we know that when our economy boosted, the banking system, the capitalist system, stock markets, and all these, we can say, financial systems of the West all of a sudden came to Iran in order to get a kind of economic development. But all of a sudden, this development, as imitated by the West, has made a gap between the poor and the rich. Now we are not talking about the ideal land. We are talking about the comparison that is happening before. For your information, Brother Naghavi, we have homeless people in Iran. We have the people who are looking in the garbages for the food. We have. And this is really sad. But as you said, we can have it in the most utopia land of the U.S. And now we are talking about the pathology. I mean, what are the problems over here? Brother Ali Alevian, the question for you is this. Now, regarding the social justice and these the gap that exists between the wealthy and the poor, some people say that before the Islamic Revolution of Iran, industry has not been that much developed. And the monarchical life of Shah has made it very much clear for the people that he is living like a king and they are living like a simple people, okay? And because the industry was not that much improved, we did not have the power in order to achieve such industrial economic development out of the natural resources. But after Enqilab, we had such, we can say, achievements, and we could do that out of the natural resources and distribute it among the people. What's your answer to that, brother?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. May Allah's peace and blessings be upon the Holy Prophet of Islam, Muhammad, and his purified progeny. Well, the realization of social justice as the topic of our discussion is usually the most important trump card of governments, not only in Iran, but in any part of the world. Actually, the governments or those who want to win an election, they just focus on this very important issue, and they say that we're going to work for the social justice of the society. But as the discussion was moving to it, does this mean that, for example, we just compare a poor person and portray a poor person with a prosperous and wealthy person in a government and bring them together and bring them in one scene on the screen and say, okay, look, this society has nothing. It is actually violating the rights of people with regard to the social justice.
Okay.
Honestly, it cannot be a good measure or criteria. It cannot be a good criteria to measure this value, because poverty and wealth, and poor and rich, have always been within the societies in the course of history. So this is not a good criteria to look at. if we want to have a good comparison, I think with regard to what you called it at the time of Shah or last king, there are some characteristics that are given to scientists, or I don't know, the knowledgeable people in the scene of economy who are dealt with this and involved in this series of actually actions and to bring statistics. They usually say that let's look at different classes of society. Look, in a society, in a normal society, usually there are three different classes of people: lower classes, middle classes, and aristocrats. We can judge that at the time of Shah, at the time of King, how many of Iranian people were included in the first, second, or the third class. This is a good judgment, I think, that we can reach to. In case people, well, most of them, most of the society were put in the first class, that is low, it means that there was no social justice. When the second class is becoming fat and becomes more, actually the number of the people who are included in the second class, that is middle class, it means that the other two are shrinking and are becoming smaller. So this society is going towards a sort of social justice, but we cannot actually imagine a perfect social justice in any society except in the desired government and utopian government that we are waiting for at the time of Imam of the Age, Imam Mahdi.
That's right. And but till that time, we have to do our best.
This is our duty to reach and to struggle to reach to that level of inshallah justice.
Okay.
So this was even, we can say, even at the time of the Holy Prophet,
yes,
or the time of imams, yes, specifically Imam Ali alayhi salam, mm-hmm, weren't there any poor in the society? So whom were those who Imam alayhi salam were helping at the midst of the nights? So who was, I mean, the times that Imam was carrying bunches of food for those poor people of his society.
That's right.
So it means that, I don't want to say that we are going to justify that there must be some poor people in our society. No, we have to cut the roots of this poverty.
Yes, we have some
but
shortcomings.
But when the society actually is moving toward the second class, this middle class,
okay,
it means that aristocrats are shrinking at the same time. The low and poor class of the society are getting smaller.
So that's right. That's right. And that spirit must be kept, you know, and the new generation must understand this, especially in Iran. Thank you, my Sayyid Mohsen Naqvi and Brother Ali Alavian, for your nice elaboration regarding the social, of course, it was socioeconomic justice in Iran after the 1979. We say we are not still talking about a very ideal land. We are elaborating on a comparison made between the Islamic Revolution of Iran and the regime before that, before 1979, and the developments that Iran made after 1979. Thank you much, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, for listening to this episode of Viewpoints. Do not forget to visit our website at parstoday.com/EN, Call of Islam page. Also, a YouTube channel, Call of Islam Radio. To another episode, God bless you all. Fi amanallah. كان وقام الإمام قام الإمام قام الإمام وقامت برايا وكر الأنام كر الأنام قام الإمام جماهير إيران في صحوة تداعت إلى الساح وسط الزحام وقامت أسودا
لك بالحمين نداء السماء وغيث الغمام.
وعاد الإمام إلى أرضه ليملأ عدلا بلاد الكرام.
Iranian Radio Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
This is
for a better life.
For a better life.
فرمود بعثت لأتمم مكارم الأخلاق.
The Holy Prophet of Islam says, "I have been sent to complete noble manners."
In the name of Allah, the Most Compassionate, the Most Merciful, we send our peace and blessings upon all the prophets of Allah, Subhanahu wa Taala. And especially the last of them, Muhammad al-Mustafa and his progeny, and those companions who followed their path. I'm your host, Sayyid Wahid Alawi, and welcome to another program of For a Better Life, here on IRIB English Radio. Today, I will be speaking about the cause of psychic afflictions. We have psychological diseases in our society today. In a social environment where people's thoughts revolve around the axis of materialism, especially in our modern society with the ideology of modernism and postmodernism, where materialism is in the center of our society, where wealth and passing material comforts are considered the criteria of prosperity and misfortune, and where everyone is constantly after the satisfaction of this inner urge, life is undoubtedly full of stress and anxiety. That is because no matter however and how much one's efforts may be, he or she cannot satisfy his endless greed, which is filled with mental vacuum, and realize all his desires and wishes, because there would always be someone else who has more than you and me. Thus, this carnal soul of ours will always want more and more, and would never be satisfied with those desires and wishes and goals that we have in life. We will always want more. Often there arise obstacles in the way of these desires and goals, which lead man into various kinds of misgivings and torments. His mind and nerves are greatly disturbed as a result of this mental vexation. Moreover, since his attachment is to enduring things which are prone every moment to destruction and extinction, their transitory charm cannot give tranquility or serenity to his tormented life. Such a person, dear brothers and sisters, no doubt, will not feel happy within himself. The pursuit of happiness, which many people today talk about and try to pursue, is nothing to be pursued about. You do not pursue happiness. Happiness should be right now. You should feel serenity right now. And in everything you do, there should be happiness. You have to elevate your soul to that level of happiness. You have to elevate yourself so that you can feel happiness in everything you do, in all acts. Another important factor that causes spiritual anguish is the thought of death and absolute extinction that many of us have. We think that death is extinction, is synonymous with annihilation. But in the Islamic faith, it is just a bridge or just a station to reach another station. A bridge between the two realms, the intermediate realm, which we call Barzakh, and the material universe. So death is a bridge between those two realms. And it is also a station to another station. It will link us, death will link us to the other realms.
We were given so many prizes. We changed the desert into oases. We built buildings of different lengths and sizes. And we felt so very satisfied. We bought and bought and couldn't stop buying. We gave charity to the poor cause we couldn't stand the crying. We thought we paid our dues, but in fact, to ourselves we're just lying. Oh, I'm walking with my head lowered in shame for my place. I'm walking with my head lowered for my race. Yes, it's easy to blame everything on the West, when in fact our focus should be on ourselves. I'm walking with my head lowered in shame for my place. I'm walking with my head lowered for my race. Yes, it's easy to blame everything on the West, when in fact our focus should be on ourselves. Is it satisfied? Is Allah satisfied? Is Allah satisfied?
When death is believed to be the last limit of life and the end of everything, the awesome phantom of non-existence darkens the soul and pours bitterness into every joy of life. Psychic strain, despair, and despondency, especially in the later part of life, will put him or her in a state of painful mental torture. Thus, we need to study a little bit about death, talk with teachers about death, and see what the reality of death is. Or at least read about what the reality of death is and reach a logic result of our research. Maybe we cannot feel what death is or see what death is with spiritual visions, with shuhud, but we may at least, the least level, the lowest of those levels, is that we can understand logically, or try to understand logically, what death is, as a bridge that would link us to the next realm. And when we understand what lies behind death, and when we read about different masters and spiritual teachers and what they have said about death, then maybe we can feel a small bit of release and serenity, because we trust those people who have reached high levels of spirituality. And when they talk about what they have witnessed, when they talk about death, we feel tranquility because we trust their words. Similarly, a haunting fear of encountering some undefined danger, something one fears without being able to express precisely what terrifies him. Misgivings and apprehensions cripple the soul and shatters man's nerves like a sledgehammer. This is the feeling that many of us may have when we have uncertainty about death and what lies behind death. One becomes constantly listless as a result of financial insecurity. Another aspect is the unmanageable wealth and a thousand financial cares that you need to think about. All of those things that you need to think about. They might be financial, they might be family issues, they might be a thousand other obstacles that has to do with your physical body, the mental perspective, and the spiritual perspective. All of those things that may cause your nerves to shackle, to shake, and reach a level where you do not feel that you are happy, or you might not feel that you are cared enough or loved enough, and all of those other things that may give you uncertainty. All of those things will give you despair, and those are the things that we will talk about, inshallah ta'ala, in more detail in future programs. Till next time, may Allah's peace and blessings be upon all of you.
Your mercy, your love is all I need. Your love is all I need. All I need, 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 oh, 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 love is all I need.
Italians are in the midst of a multifaceted crisis. Italy has been hit particularly hard by the COVID-19 pandemic, with one of the highest death tolls in the world. The Eurozone's third biggest economy is meanwhile suffering from one of the worst downturns in decades. And now, political chaos triggered by the collapse of the coalition government last week is making the situation much worse. Some say it is the most perilous time for Italians since World War II. Italian President Sergio Mattarella has brought in this man to try to resolve the situation and put Italy on the right track, Mario Draghi, former head of the European Central Bank. He received a mandate earlier this week to form a new coalition government. Hopes are high for Draghi to find a way forward.
Well, Mario Draghi certainly has the experience of high-level politics and is broadly respected by both politicians and by the population. The man who famously said, whatever it takes, is broadly credited with saving the euro following the last recession in 2008-2009 and the subsequent sovereign debt crisis. So he definitely has the respect of people. Whether that then can translate into forming but maintaining a government in Italy remains to be seen.
Italy's financial markets reacted positively to a sudden arrival on the political scene. The star technocrat is extremely efficient under pressure. He steered the Eurozone through the financial crisis during his tenure as president of the European Central Bank. He is widely credited with saving both the Eurozone and the euro currency. His performance as the president of the European Central Bank became a source of national pride for Italians. The 73-year-old economist now has broad support among many major political parties, but Italian politics is a dangerous place, especially for technocrats and economists like him. After losing his Senate majority last week, Giuseppe Conte resigned as Italian prime minister. The crisis was triggered after a decision by former Prime Minister Matteo Renzi to withdraw his liberal Italia Viva party out of the centrist coalition government. Renzi was opposed to Conte's plan to spend well over 200 billion euros of EU recovery funds on the coronavirus crisis. Observers believe doubts about the outgoing government's ability to properly spend the money led to its collapse. But Draghi is widely believed to be capable of handling such sums because he is an experienced economist. But has he really got what it takes to be Italy's next prime minister? He is right now trying to unite as many political parties as he can. The former ECB chief wants to secure broad cross-party support because of the daunting challenges facing Italy.
Italy is particularly difficult to form and maintain a government. The main reason is that it usually requires a fairly broad coalition of a number of different political parties. What that does is put together people with competing ideologies or competing and differing views of how the government and indeed the country should be run. This creates a situation where the smaller parties actually have disproportionate amount of power.
So far, the centre-left Democratic Party has given him its backing. Renzi's Italia Viva party has pledged unconditional support for Draghi. Centre-right Forza Italia, former Prime Minister Silvio Berlusconi, also suggested that it might be ready to help out. But the right-wing league insists that it will not support a government backed by Five Star. All eyes are on Draghi now. He is considered a hero for the Eurozone. Can he unite the Italians at this time of crisis?
Hezbollah said it shot down an Israeli drone near the border town of Blida. The downing of the drone comes as the Israeli military has recently intensified its violations of the Lebanese airspace as part of what Hezbollah calls an ongoing spying operation against the resistance movement. Hezbollah fighters have so far downed several unmanned Israeli aircraft over the Lebanese territory. But Tel Aviv's frequently violating Lebanon's airspace is seen by many as a flagrant violation of UN Security Council Resolution 1701 and the country's sovereignty.
I think that Israel really is disregarding territorial sovereignty in general in Lebanon, in Gaza, and other places as well, Syria, Iraq. Israel has bombed militia in Iraq, and it's also involved. It's attacked forces in Libya as well. So I don't think that Israel really cares about honoring international protocols, international law. It just at will violate any country's territory as long as it feels it's in its interest to do so. And I think it's been violating Lebanese territory for decades, really.
But such Israeli violations are not limited to Lebanon. On Tuesday, Palestinian resistance forces downed an Israeli drone in southern Gaza and took control of it. The Israeli military confirmed one of its drones crashed in Gaza, but claimed there was, quote, no danger of information leak. On Sunday, Palestinian fighters also shot down an Israeli quadcopter, which was conducting an espionage mission over Beit Hanun crossing in Gaza's northern border with the occupied territories. The Israeli military frequently uses drones over the Gaza Strip either to monitor and photograph Palestinian military units or bomb specified targets.
It uses drones regularly in Lebanon, I think, too, and in the Gaza Strip. It uses them for intelligence gathering. It's trying to watch what people do in those places. It's looking for militant activities that could be construed as, building missiles. It's looking for people that might be building tunnels under Gaza to defend Gaza in the next invasion from Israel. So these drones are an important intelligence tool for Israel, and drones are important intelligence tools for all the countries that make drones, the United States as well, and countries where it's involved in the Middle East.